6:30 p.m.
Watch a weekly counter propaganda and left opinion program here on your people supported free radio station KBOO Portland. I'll try that again. This is Press Watch. And I'm Teresa Mitchell. Join me for a brief peek behind the video veil of Monopoly media manipulation and an examination of the news you're not supposed to know. Well, I wanted to talk about the State of the Union and a few other things. I want to talk about the flu update. There's a bit of headlines from Radio Havana, Cuba. And it turns out they're fracking in Coos Bay. And I've mentioned these things. I'm going to use some KBOO news stories in part of this. This was from KBOO Evening News, part of these stories are. But to start with the flu update, The Guardian in the UK says last week Public Health England announced that this winter, three times as many people have died from flu compared to the previous year. Australia saw a doubling in the number of deaths, and the figures are also up in Europe and the US. From the US News and World Report, in an article by Dr. Kevin Campbell, this year's flu season is one of the worst in decades. Thousands of Americans have been diagnosed with flu, and many have suffered severe complications, including death, which is a hell of a complication, if you think about it. In fact, since October 1st, 2017, they write, more than 80,000 cases have been confirmed in the U.S. alone by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the season has not yet peaked. While the flu shot is vital for the prevention of outbreaks, this year's vaccination does not appear to be a great match, and this has contributed to the widespread outbreaks. The predominant strain, he writes, is H3N2, and it's particularly virulent. It produces severe symptoms. The telltale symptoms of the flu include high fever, cough, runny nose, sore throat, body aches. The flu peaks in January typically, but he writes the flu season can last until March or April. February is also American Heart Month, so he wrote that the flu can be associated with an increased risk of heart attack, and he quotes the New England Journal of Medicine, which I'll go to directly. They write that acute myocardial infarction can be triggered by acute respiratory infections. Previous studies have suggested an association between influenza and acute myocardial infarction, heart attacks in other words, but those studies used nonspecific measures of influenza infection or study designs that were susceptible to bias. And they write, we evaluated the association between laboratory-confirmed influenza infection and acute myocardial infarction. This is, as I said, from the New England Journal of Medicine with Jeffrey C. Kwong et al. In their study. And skipping ahead to their conclusions, they found a significant association between respiratory infections, especially influenza, and heart attack. And that was funded by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research and others. And going back to the U.S. News and World Report article, the significant association was six times more likely to get a heart attack after getting the flu. So there's a rather serious aspect to the flu, and that will, I suppose, someday affect the statistics associated with influenza mortality. But it's not now, and so you should know. From Radio Havana, Cuba, several uncontacted Amazon tribes could be devastated after the government of Peru passed a law declared of national interest that allows the construction of roads in an area of the Amazon border with Brazil. The area in the remote region of Ucayu, home to the largest concentration of isolated indigenous peoples on Earth, is subjected to several illegal roads already. They say uncontacted indigenous peoples have the right to their land, as recognized by Peruvian legislation and international law. However, the rivers are already getting polluted with mercury from the gold miners. Pope Francis, in declarations made in Peru just a few days before the highway law was passed, urged to break with the historical paradigm that considers the Amazon as just an inexhaustible storehouse of the states without taking into account their inhabitants. And Radio Havana, Cuba writes, the isolated indigenous peoples are the most vulnerable on the planet, and it is estimated that there are about 15 uncontacted tribes as well in Peru, many of which are in the region where the road would be built. We have a very similar story from Oregon, I'm sorry to say, and I'll be getting to that in a minute. But first I want to talk about Trump's State of the Union speech. I would say it would have been rather unpleasant to watch, and I certainly did not. I would not. And I'll bet you didn't either. I think Trump's speech shows that he intends to rule from his fanatic base, his 30%. And I would say that his speech was a success as an apartheid tactic. He told, in the process of going over his policy ideas, he told 13 sophisticated, subliminally painted race stories. The first story was the Cajun Navy comes to the rescue in Texas. And when I was talking about this on the KBOO Evening News yesterday, Zealous Marchant pointed out that one would normally assume that Trump would want to avoid any reference to the fact that it was a volunteer effort that was first to the fray when the hurricane hit Texas. In other words, you would think that would make Trump not look so good. But the intent and the effect of this reference is entirely different. It is addressed to people who do not have the sophistication or social analysis to notice that fact. It is addressed to Trump's minority white evangelical base. Cajuns are white people, culturally and genetically linked to French-Canadian Acadia, hence the name Cajuns. They race to the rescue. This is the first thing. The visual image in that memory will be white people to the rescue. The second story was about Ali Leppert, white Coast Guard helicopter pilot, to the rescue. The third story is about Dave Dahlberg, white firefighter, to the rescue. The fourth story was about a white survivor of left violence, member of Congress. The fifth story, Steve Staub and Sandy Keplinger, white business success stories. The sixth story was about Corey Adams, and he was a black welder, and he's the grateful recipient of the job from the aforementioned whites. This is the first person of color mentioned. The seventh story is about Preston Sharp, a nice little white boy, bringing American flags to veterans' graves. And that also is a visual image, an image of white innocence and subservience to the wars. This is to be contrasted in the mind with anyone viewed as disrespecting the flag. In Trumpian minds, say Colin Kaepernick. The eighth story was about Evelyn Rodriguez, Freddie Cuevas, Elizabeth Alvarado, and Robert Mickens, their two teenage daughters, Kayla and Nisa, brown people targeted by bad MS-13 brown people victims. So here again, an accurate analysis, might note that MS-13 originated as a gang of Americans expatriated from El Salvador by the Reagan-era death squad there, but Trump's base does not have that memory capacity. So let's go to the ninth story in the series, threaded through the State of the Union address. The ninth story is about Celestino Martinez, a brown person fighting brown persons, as a white ICE protects Trump's America versus MS-13. Seeing a pattern? Story 10, Ryan Holitz, hero drug baby adopting white mother saved a baby from a vicious poor mother who is going to kill the baby. This neatly adds an anti-poor narrative. The baby is named Hope, which of course is what the poor did not have under Trump capitalism. Story 11, Justin Peck, hero soldier who rescued soldier woman Kenton Stacy, white soldier protecting a white woman against not white enough Syrians. Story 12, Otto Warmbier, white victim of soulless North Korean agents. Story 13, last and presented as ominous, Ji Sung Ho, a Christian Asian amputee victim of the aforementioned soulless Asians, the North Koreans, in other words, in this mythology, proud survivor escaping said Asians. All the hero stories are either white or act on behalf of white terror. And when we're talking about ICE, when we're talking about the war, when we're talking about the wall, we're talking about white terror, because that is Trump's brand. So let's analyze these visual Reagan-style stories. This is a step up in sophistication from Reagan's imaginary black welfare mother Cadillac owner, and a tactical improvement over asserting over and over that there is no collusion. Eight white people in the State of the Union address are presented as heroes, defending against hurricanes, black joblessness, Syrians' ingratitude, and the poor. One white legislator is the victim of a leftist, and one white corpse is the victim of North Korea. Seven people of color appear in the narrative, each a victim. A brown man is lionized for defending against brown people. A loyal Asian man is presented as a victim of faceless Asians. This is the narrative, to soothe and energize the racist base that elected and still defends Trump in the hopes that their whiteness can become a ticket to a better tomorrow. And for those people, lots of luck. Trump suggested a path for citizenship for dreamers. Undocumented immigrants brought to the U.S. as children, but he tied that concession to his bizarre fantasy of the Great Wall of Texifornia and an end to chain migration, which allows immigrants to bring family members to the United States. So the theme of his speech was clear to his audience. And then he did one more thing that I thought was rather creepy. He had the phrase, "I call on Congress to empower every cabinet secretary with the authority to reward good workers and to remove federal employees who undermine the public trust or fail the American people," end quote. This is code for, "I call on Congress to empower a complete purge of all employees in the government who are not pro-Trump." Although it is unlikely he could get that through Congress today, he could easily include it in absolutely any legislation considered within 72 hours of any false flag operation that resulted in bombing North Korea. And I'm beginning to think that that is a likely outcome. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You can also pick up this broadcast live right now on Twitter, Periscope. The Twitter handle is at KBOO Press Watch. And it should be live. I don't know this for a fact, but it should be live on Facebook as well under Teresa Mitchell. So now I would like to talk about the fracking industry coming to Portland. Again, this was used on KBOO News. A British investment company led by a fracking expert has begun production and development of gas wells in the mountains near Coos Bay, Oregon. Curzon Energy, helmed by Thomas Wagenhofer, has raised millions of pounds on the British stock market, obtained wastewater permits from the state of Oregon. He has the permits. And they have reopened five gas wells and a 47,000-acre holding in Coos County Timber, pleasing investors who will immediately profit from sales. And that is their plan, to move forward by immediately producing gas. They are successful so far in that. The company plans to open 58 fracking wells in its next phase and hopes to put up to 400 wells in the timber, or one per 80 acres. Local timber owners are also set to profit as leasers of the subsoil mineral rights, although those who are hoping for jobs out of this are likely to be disappointed, as once the exploration is done, the wells take care of themselves and just pollute away without much supervision at all. The process for extracting natural gas out of the Coos County coal fields will be slightly different from that of fracking fields such as the Back and Shale Formation. Dumped wastewater will include coal oils, uranium, thorium, and radium. Fracking water for the new wells is to be dumped into the Davis Slough near the Coos Bay estuary habitat, home to salmon, herring, perch, rockfish, and many other species. The Portland Audubon Society reports that the estuary is home to the brown pelican, the great egret, the snowy plover, and several species of grebes and loons, and of course, the last few fisher weasels on Earth are in that area. Investors are very excited about the profit potential of the Oregon fracking fields, as the pipeline infrastructure is already in place and Oregon charges half as much royalty for petroleum production as does Oklahoma and Texas. And we know how industrially friendly Oregon is. For example, when Nike Corporation decided they wanted to pay even less taxes, all they had to do was go to Governor Kitzhaber, who set up a special session to give them a special break so that they can keep all their billions. Over the past few months, Curzon Energy has proudly put photographs of its Oregon drilling and production equipment on Twitter, and its stock has risen sharply. The activist group Coast Range Forest Watch has put an alert on Facebook warning of the ecological consequences, and it is no stretch to see that one well per 80 acres in the timber there in Coos County and the associated spew of fracking wastewater out of our coal beds will transform the forests of Coos County into a reeking wasteland. This for 15 years of profits, maximum, to already wealthy international investors and the false hope of extensive jobs to former timber workers. Now, Alternet points out that a new study highlights how 5 million gallons of fresh water can be used to fracture just one gas well in the U.S. They're talking about shale, but I imagine that the amount is rather similar for fracking out of oil. Fracking out of coal. That's enough to fill 7 Olympic-sized swimming pools per well. And it has depleted water levels in up to 51% of streams in Arkansas, where fracking is taking place. That's according to Motherboard, as I was saying, reported in alternet.org. So that is also a problem. In addition to the pollution, there is the simple removal of water from the area streams. The time is 9:16. You're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. I'm Teresa Mitchell. You can call in with your comments and questions at 503-231-8187. 503-231-8187. I also want to bring up Afghanistan. After 16 years and 31,000 civilian deaths, the U.S.-led occupation of Afghanistan has increasingly been threatened by the Afghan armed resistance. The Afghans have shifted to suicide car bombs and death platoons to remove the U.S. invaders. A 5-person group of fighters and suicide bombers attacked the Afghan capital Kabul, killing 11 and injuring 16 before they were themselves killed earlier this week. ISIS claimed responsibility for the action through its news agency. So ISIS is added to the Taliban in this case. The attack follows on a Taliban car bombing using an ambulance, which last week killed 103 persons, actually quite a few more than that now that I think about it, also in Kabul. In the past month, Afghan anti-occupation soldiers have attacked a cultural center, an aid agency, and the Intercontinental Hotel in the capital city. Thomas Ruddig, an analyst quoted in the Los Angeles Times, said that as attacks increase, there is a mutually escalating spiral of violence. U.S. President Trump has already directed an increase of more than 5,000 troops, bringing the total to more than 13,000 currently in the country, with thousands more present as mercenaries and logistics support. Outside Kabul, the Taliban now control or effectively contest 40% of the Afghan territories, and that figure may be low, as I'll mention in a moment. But according to a report by the Watson Institute at Brown University, the cost of the U.S.-Afghan war now exceeds $830 billion, and the cycle of U.S. wars since the invasion of Iraq in 1991 has now cost $4.79 trillion. I can add to this with information from Radio Havana, Cuba. The U.S. government's top watchdog in Afghanistan says the Pentagon has restricted the release of critical information about the U.S. war. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction has been publishing quarterly reports for years, but this week, for the first time, information about troop levels and the amount of territory controlled by the Taliban was withheld from public report under demands from the Pentagon. U.S. President Donald Trump has doubled down on the ongoing U.S. war in Afghanistan and rejected the idea of peace talks with the Taliban. Following a wave of violence in the capital, Kabul, in recent days, he said negotiations with the Taliban were off the table and threatened to, in his words, finish what we have to finish, end quote. All right, and have some callers. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187, and Sam is on the phone.
Well, good morning, Teresa.
Good morning.
Hey, can I go back to the flu?
Sure.
Okay, so it really hurts my heart to hear people talking about the flu and my friends who are sick, and they're sick for days on end. And we have the medicine growing right here outside our door.
And what are you growing outside your door?
We have an herbal preparation. We have a plant in the gorge called Lomatium dissectum. And it was used by the Washoe people during the influenza pandemic of 1917 and 18. And they lost not one single victim to the flu.
Lomatium, you say?
Yes.
How do you spell that?
With an L, Lomatium, T-I-U-M, dissectum.
All right.
Desert parsley.
Desert parsley, okay. Well, that's very interesting. Thank you.
Yeah. So look up the experience with the Washoe people, and let's talk to people about herbal antivirals. It's way more effective than Tamiflu or, holy cow, that vaccine that the CDC keeps pimping.
Well, if you look up Tamiflu, you find that there are some serious questions as to its efficacy, and certainly it has been a profit generator for Gilead and for its part owners, former Secretary of State George Shultz, and for Donald Rumsfeld.
Right. Okay, that's all I had, Teresa. Thanks for the call.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and Jeff is on the air.
Well, hi.
Hi.
I don't like being depressed, but all these stories just make me more frightened and sad. I'm not going to go there. I just wanted to point out, I know you didn't watch, Teresa, and I didn't watch too much. I watched only to confirm what I was listening to.
No, I got the transcript. That's all I can stand.
You know, I've lived through 10 presidents now. This is my 10th. And I never once, not ever, ever, have I seen a president, whilst delivering a State of the Union message, actually applaud himself. This is the definition of claptrap. He actually applauded himself and encouraged others to keep applauding him. It was so absolutely revolting. And thanks for pointing out the very valid points in the address, but the body language was utterly disgusting. And I thought, you hadn't seen it and you should know that.
All right, well, thank you for that.
Thanks, Teresa.
Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. And you're listening to Press Watch on KBOO Portland. And coming up at 9:30, we'll have Per Fogering with Fight the Empire. And at 10 o'clock, more of our radio zine. And I think possibly with Chris Andre, although I'll have to check on that. So you're listening to KBOO. The number to call, 503-231-8187. And been talking about the Afghan War, been talking about the influenza. And I've been talking about fracking here in Oregon, and I just want to say that when I discovered that fracking was going on, I checked from time to time over the last few years, and the last I had checked a couple of years ago, there was absolutely no fracking going on, and the only wells, the only gas wells were these few that come out of these coal beds in, that are underneath the timber in the Coastal Range Mountains between the sea and the peak of those mountains. There are many coal beds. There are many mining claims if you look it up online, and they go back quite a ways. It's been a long time since coal mining was profitable. But several gas wells had been set up. Their flow rate had been rather low, and for whatever reason, probably undercapitalization, plus a collapse in the petroleum market, which happens from time to time, those gas wells were not producing. So this company, this British company, saw these wells and thought, well, they can make these wells that are already in place. There's like five wells already in place. Pardon me. They can make these wells produce more. And then by proving that they can get gas, they can raise enough money to create this fracking horror, this fracking monstrosity. They want to put in an additional 58 wells and their phase two, which is now pretty much underway. They want to go out in, I believe it's April, and start putting out 58 more wells, taking the water from the local streams, pumping it into the coal beds underneath the timber and then pumping it back up and dumping it into the slough and the estuary. And this should horrify you, because this will produce the same devastation that fracking has produced everywhere else, and they would very much like to put 400 wells into that territory. Number to call, 503-231-8187, and George is on the air.
Hey, Teresa, if you are on fracking now and don't want to take a question which would take you back for maybe a
minute. No, go ahead. That's fine.
To Afghanistan, I want to ask about there was a pipeline, was it to go to China or somewhere through Afghanistan a few years ago, or maybe I've got that wrong. You probably know. Could you just resume that if you have time?
U.S. corporate envoys went to Afghanistan and told the government there, told the Taliban that they could have a carpet of gold or a carpet of bombs. And then, of course, we know historically that after the 9/11 stunt, the U.S. government went again to the Taliban and accused them of harboring the mastermind, although there has never been a trial of Osama bin Laden, and I rather doubt that he was actually the mastermind of the 9/11 events.
Could I butt in for just...
Yes, minute? Go ahead.
I just wanted to know about if there was a pipeline. I'm sure I read an article a few months ago or a year ago that said there had been a pipeline, an oil pipeline scheduled to go through Afghanistan.
Well, I'd be rather surprised if there are no oil pipelines and gas pipelines going through Afghanistan at this point.
Okay, that's what I appreciate your, and I'll get off and listen to your program. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in. Number to call with your comments and questions, 503-231-8187. I've been denouncing the war in Afghanistan, and as I was saying, there's never actually been a reason for invading those people in the first place. Afghanistan is known as the graveyard of empires, and it certainly was that for the Soviet Union. It was encouraged as such for the Soviet Union by the U.S., who funded fanatic extremists who happened to be Muslim, because they were there in Afghanistan, because they were opposing the Soviets. It cost the Soviets billions of equivalent dollars, and led that, and Chernobyl very much led to their economic collapse and the victory of Reaganism. And that's what we have for history. Number to call, 503, excuse me. Good day to do the influenza story. I do not have influenza. Number to call, 503-231-8187. And it appears that I'm just telling my engineer, it appears that my battery on my computer has fizzled, so I won't be able to get notifications that way. And Harry is next.
Oh, hello, Teresa. And
hi, Harry.
For taking my call. It was mentioned a couple of days ago, and no one really caught it, that FEMA has stopped food deliveries to Costa
to Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico. And I thought this was terrible. And they still have, one-third of the island still has no electricity.
Well, FEMA said that... Oh, how nice. Someone's brought me water again. FEMA said that they were going to cut off aid. News got around. It was on Democracy Now! And then FEMA said that they were not going to cut off aid. So I'm a little confused as to what is actually going to happen. But as I've said several times, the model for what is happening in Puerto Rico right now is the very profitable Katrina disaster and the very racist and very profitable corporate invasion of that region post-Hurricane Katrina. That's what's being done now. Let's see, what was the name of the hurricane? Was it Maria?
Maria and Irma.
Yeah, two hurricanes, actually. And they still have a very substantial proportion of the countryside does not have power, and this has had ramifications on the influenza epidemic in the U.S. because most of the IV bags that are distributed around U.S. hospitals are made in Puerto Rico, and there was quite a delay in that manufacture due to the sluggishness in restoring power. So we all pay for that, and I would like to add, we certainly pay in tax dollars, and our grandchildren will pay in tax dollars for the Afghan war. And if Trump can get his Korea war going through, we will pay in new and horrific ways, I do believe.
Yeah. One last comment and question.
All right.
You mentioned on a previous show you turn 60 years old.
Oh, I'll be 60 this year, yeah.
Yeah, and I was hoping maybe you would have a birthday show and everything that happened in 1958, locally here in Oregon, nationally and internationally, some of the things that happened. I turned 60 last year, and I remember I was reading some of the things that happened in 1957, and one of the things was that that Eisenhower activated the National Guard to go to Tennessee to reopen the one of these school districts that was ordered to desegregate, and they actually closed the thing. I'm trying to figure out how did they force teachers to go back to work.
Well, that's an interesting idea, and it's good to know that history, so I'll consider that. But, you know, I've run out of time, and so it's time for my closing music, and I see Perifogring through the window of the door here in Production 2. So we're about to have that, Fight the Empire. Stay tuned. You've been listening to Press Watch on KBOO 90.7 FM in Portland and other frequencies in Cascadia and via KBOO.FM to all the ships at sea.
You've been listening to Press Watch here on KBOO Community Radio. The time is 9:30. Coming up next, we've got Fight the Empire with host Perifogering. After that, Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with host Chris Andre. And then Flashpoints. All morning, we've got a great lineup at 11 on Between the Covers. David Naiman welcomes Maria Machado and her new book, Her Body and Other Parties. And 11:30, it's Black Book Talk. KBOO keeps you informed. You can get involved. Go to KBOO.FM and click on Donate to become a member today.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring an archivist. This contract position will steward the KBOO archival assets in all forms, all kinds of audio formats, as well as the document and electronic archives. Priorities for this position are to manage the Resource Space Archival Database, in particular the entry of metadata, and to support staff and volunteers during the 50th anniversary celebrations. Deadline for this position is Monday, February 5th, 2018 at 5 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm/archivist-hire-2018.
Well, good morning. It's Perifogering, and the show is Fight the Empire. And my topic is the state of the empire. But before I get to that, I'd like to say a few words about Robert Perry, who passed away this last weekend. He's been a guest on this show two or three times, and an invaluable resource. And he wrote a lot about he's based in Washington. And there's so much, what he called a groupthink going on there. And he was one of the few voices of sanity coming out of Washington. And you could always count on him to give you good facts and give you some kind of insight into what's happening in Washington. And we're really going to miss the guy. I mean, it's... His consortium news will continue. His sons are, always been helping him with it. And consortium news has got a lot of good writers. I would really encourage people to go to Consortium News if you want to find out what's happening in Washington and elsewhere. Robert Perry has been greatly missed. I'm not sure cable listeners have heard Flashpoints and Margaret Prescott's show yesterday, I believe. So it's great sadness. We notice note the passing of Robert Perry. He's had a long and distinguished career going back to the 80s when the U.S. Was making war on the people of Central America. And he's exposed so much going on there and elsewhere. So anyway, farewell to Robert Perry. He's really not gone. George Kennan was back in the 40s and 50s is one of the great gurus of U.S. foreign policy. And actually, just about 70 years ago this month, he wrote a presidential position paper, and it in which he outlined the reason for sort of the U.S.'s role in the world. And this is what he said. This is a presidential policy statement 23 from February of 1948, 70 years ago. He said, quote, "The U.S. has 50% of the world's wealth, but only 6.3% of its population. Our real task in the coming period is to devise a pattern of relationships which permits us to maintain this position of disparity. To do so, we will have to dispense with all sentimentality and daydreaming, and our attention will have to be concentrated everywhere on our immediate national objectives. We should cease to talk about vague and unreal objectives such as human rights, the raising of living standards, and democratization. The day is not far off when we are going to have to deal in straight power concepts. The less we are hampered by idealistic slogans, the better." Well, that was George Kennan back in 48, and things have not really changed a whole lot since then. The U.S., has 5% of the world's population, and it uses up 25% of the world's energy, also produces 25% of the world's waste. Almost half of the world's top 1% income-wise live in the United States. If you are making more than $34,000 a year after taxes, you are part of the world's 1%, top 1%. It's so what in a world where if the world was had unlimited resources, you could say this doesn't matter very much. But actually, the world is very limited as far as resources go. And what that means is that when the United States gets more, others get less. And it's not just the United States. Europe is sort of in the same position, too. And there's a very good report out. It's called Honest Accounts with a question mark after it. And it's a report that was commissioned by I believe Oxfam and the Jubilee people and some other NGOs, and it was it went into all the money that goes into Africa and what comes out of Africa, sort of like an accounting. Well, that's what the title of the thing is about, an honest accounting, and they concluded that every year, now this report was commissioned about 3 or 4 years ago, and they concluded that when you think of what goes into Africa and what goes out, that Africa loses $58 billion each year. In other words, $134 billion comes into Africa, $192 billion comes out. net loss of $58 billion a year. And that report was from a few years back, but things haven't changed very much. And it shows, you know, it gives you an idea of what the countries, namely the West, are gaining and what countries are losing. And right now, an example would be, you think of all the electronic toys and products that we use, and these electronic gadgets and machinery, they all depend on a rare mineral called coltan. Actually, it's two minerals combined. And coltan is produced by slave labor in Congo. So this is just one example. Our computers, our phones, our electronic games, everything like that, all depend on coltan, which is dug up in Congo by people under slave-like conditions. Well, what this sounds like to me, I think you could call it American privilege. In other words, that just by being an American, you get certain privileges that are paid for by other people. So you think, what would our lives be like without this privilege? Well, a lot of what America consumes is waste. When you talk about energy, our energy supplies, we use about twice as much as Europe does. And you can't say that Europe lives worse than we do. In fact, in many ways, they live better than we do, but they use their energy much more efficiently. And we could do that too. And we could have actually pay for the amount of electricity that we use. Suppose you had a graduated electric bill where, say, the first chunk of electricity comes at a very cheap rate, and this would sort of give poor people, you know, at least they would have heating and cooling, and they would have cooking, refrigeration, and all that. They would have the basics at a reasonable price. But then you get kicked up to the next level where you have to pay more for a similar amount of electricity. It'd be like a real income tax as far as energy goes. And so you get your electric bill, and you see that I think our electric bills right now are modified in this way. You pay a certain amount for a certain number of kilowatt hours, and then it goes up. Well, suppose it went up much more steeply, and you paid a real much bigger amount for a much bigger electric usage. What would you give up if you wanted to keep your electric bill down? Would you give up the electronic games? Would you give up air conditioning? What would you give up? My impression is that some of these electronic games people wouldn't give. That'd be the last thing to go. They would rather starve. In fact, I just heard recently about some guy. He spent something like 20 hours straight with his computer games, and he sat in that chair so long that he was unable to paralyze him from the waist down. Now, that's just some headline I saw, so maybe somebody might check that out. But it might be something to think about. This is sort of what our American privilege does to people. President Trump gave his speech the other day, and he talked a lot about, one thing he talked about was going after North Korea. And Trump is just itching to give North Korea what they call a bloody nose. Now, this is really a crazy scheme. There are people who are seriously thinking about this in the foreign policy establishment. A guy named Edward Ludwack wrote an article in Foreign Policy magazine. And the idea being that you don't mount a full-fledged nuclear attack on North Korea, but you give them some kind of attack, and somehow you're supposed to let them know that this is just sort of like a punch in the nose, and it's not going to get any worse, and this will presumably discipline North Korea to be less of a nuisance to us, and that it will tell North Korea that we're not out to destroy them completely, and that they will be less likely to respond in some bad way. Well, to me, when you think about that, that is a completely crazy notion. Apparently, Donald Trump goes along with it, but he is not the only one. There are lots of other people in Washington who have this idea. Somehow we can give North Korea the bloody nose to keep them in line, and that they will not respond in any belligerent way. Well, this is kind of crazy. There's a lot of talk about North Korea can presumably attack the mainland of the United States with nuclear weapons, but they don't have to do that. They can wipe out South Korea very easily, even without nukes. They could do the same with Tokyo. Well, is the U.S. going to let Seoul and Japan go down the drain, be destroyed? That is another crazy notion coming out of the foreign policy establishment. And we got a caller on the line. Let's go to the Jack is on the line. Good morning, Jack.
Hi, Pierre. Thanks for covering all this geopolitics in a way that's deeper than what we get almost everywhere else. Appreciated. The belligerence of the nation at this point in time should be frightening to the entire world. They talk about losing wars. We can't lose the war in Afghanistan. There's no intention of winning anything there. It's just destabilization.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people have to understand. I think that what are we closing in on now here? 15 years of war, being called the global war on terror. Anybody who studies it understands immediately it's the global war of terror, and the point is just to have terror everywhere.
Right.
It can destabilize chaotic nations incapable of protecting their citizenry against the agenda of the hegemons, the IMF, the World Bank, their hitmen, NATO. It's so obvious. I can't understand how the official narrative doesn't come unraveled in the
well. It should when you think about it. I've been thinking about this. You know, yeah, we haven't won a war since I don't know when, but still we are at it, and it could be. That's be something to think about. Maybe we don't have to win.
The point is not to win anything, just to keep the war going.
Well, right, for two reasons. For two reasons. One, it keeps the adversary in total disarray, and it destroys them. So in a sense, we're selling protection. When we go around the world offering military alliances, what we're doing is saying, well, you join up with us, and you will not be destroyed like Afghanistan. And the other side to this is that it keeps our arm makers, our manufacturers happy. Right now, Donald Trump is going to ask for $716 billion for the next war budget. And this is totally crazy. When you think of all the things in the United States that need money, schools, roads, health care, just everything that helps people, and they are begging for money, And but there's all this money is going for going to the Pentagon and the arms makers. This is totally crazy. But
the global arms industry. I never see it reported anywhere when they talk about, let's say, the car bombing in Kabul. Well, quick analysis could tell you probably where the ordnance came from. You know, when they kill a bunch of insurgents and they got they're armed. You know, there's weapons, there's munitions. Where does this stuff come from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, tell us the arms path, and I'll bet. And I mean, I want to do the research, but and someone must have done it out there. But I would bet most of it comes from the West, from the U.S., from arms makers in Europe. But you know, it's not a big mystery. This conflagration is going running across the Middle East and reaching out all over around the world is fueled by the global arms industry.
Well, you know, last
every side, mm-hmm. every side.
Well, I got an article. You know, this guy, his name is Jack Ma. He's a Chinese billionaire. He's the guy who started the Alibaba Corporation, which I guess is their version of Amazon. And he was at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland last year. And he said in the past 30 years, America had 13 wars spending $2 trillion. What was the money spent on them? And he said, it's not that other countries steal jobs from you guys. It's your strategy. You did not distribute the money and things in a proper way. Basically, he's telling the Davos Forum last year that this trillions of dollars for war is a wasted money, and it is destroying this country. So it's it shouldn't
so
be.
We need a foreigner to lecture our envoys on that.
Well, China's, you know, their military budget I think is about 10% of what ours is, or maybe a little higher than that. But it's very modest, and they're spending their money on this Asian, this new Silk Roads project, which is sort of linked together Asia and Europe, the whole Eurasian continent. And it's like this might point the way to a solution to the whole thing with Korea. Right now, the Chinese, you can take a train from Shanghai to Europe, to Portugal. And it gets there in half the time, that it takes to go by boat. And we're talking about cargoes here, things like that. And the project, the rail lines would eventually link to South Korea. And well, to link to South Korea, it would have to go through North Korea. And so, you know, we're talking about North Korea being isolated and all that. Well, they could be part of this new Silk Roads project, and they could be linked with, Trump keeps hoping that China will sort of resolve the situation. Well, this is how China could resolve the situation if North Korea would go along with it. And I don't know if this is what the United States really wants. I don't think they want to see this new Silk Roads project come into being. But it seems to me the only viable way out of all this war and stuff in Asia. But anyway, thank you very much for your call. I'd like to say one thing about, people talk about the economy, and I think we need to realize that the economy does not run on money. It runs on energy. Cheap oil, cheap energy is what has given the United States its wealth all these years. I think it was 1859 when the first commercial oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania. They struck oil at 69 feet. And then you go after that, you know, you had all these big gushers in Texas and Oklahoma. You know, you didn't have to drill very far to come up with the oil. Now the oil, you know, you drill deeper, you drill under the oceans, you have horizontal drilling, and now you have fracking, which it's an expensive process. In other words, the oil is not easy to get at, it is not cheap to produce, it is very expensive. So if you're talking right now, there's a story in the paper, in the news, that U.S. oil production has hit 10 million barrels a day. And they say, with great pride that the United States may become the top oil producer in the world, surpassing Saudi Arabia, surpassing Russia. The thing to keep in mind is how much of that is net profit, net energy. Because, if it takes, you can get, say, 10 million barrels a day, but what if it costs you 3 million barrels a day to drill that oil? You know, you're making a gain of 7 billion. So this is the problem with fracking. It's my understanding that no fracking company in the United States has ever made a profit. They depend on investors sinking money into the operation, which is kind of like what a Ponzi scheme does. And once you drill these wells, they have a lot of debt. And once you sink these wells, you've got all these expenses to pay. You've got all this debt to pay off. And so you just produce like crazy just to raise money to sort of keep the wolf away from the door. And that is where our fracking industry is right now. And it's the kind of thing, if you just look at the geology of it, it's expensive. You've gotten the easy oil already. All the oil you get at is more and more hard to find, hard to get. And so eventually, the law of diminishing returns takes over, and they're really you come up short. Besides the oil that you can get, there is all the what they call the sink. In other words, the waste, the stuff that has to be disposed of. And this limits the amount of oil that we can use, because if you can't deal with the waste, it's a very bad economic situation. So there are lots of, you can sort of see the handwriting on the wall that the oil economy is slowly heading for oblivion, kind of along with the United States empire. There is no future in oil. There's no future in coal. Now, there is a future in electricity. There's a future in renewables if they can resolve a few problems. But the big question is, will these renewables give us enough energy to maintain the style of life we have right now? That is an open question. My opinion is I don't think we can. I think we're going to have to cut back in many, many ways. But that might be a topic of a future fight the empire. Besides fighting the empire, we're just looking at it with a clear eye and seeing where it is going. It is going downhill, folks. I don't know if Donald Trump realizes this. So much of what he says is just kind of whistling in the graveyard, bragging. We have somebody on the phone. Let's go out with a phone call. Hello there.
Hello?
Hello, you're on the air.
Me? This is Barry.
Yes, how are you?
Yeah, hi. Just fine, thanks. I'd like to bring up a name of a book again.
Oh, you've done that before, Barry. We know about the book.
9/11 by Christopher Boland.
I know. We've been there before. I mean, if people want to read it, go ahead and read it. I'm aware of the story. And okay, but don't keep bringing it up week after week, please. If people want to read it, go ahead, read it. Check it out. But anyway, bye. So I think that's Fight the Empire for this episode. Boy, I really miss Robert Perry already. He was rewriting excellent stuff on what's going on in Washington now. One thing to keep in mind is that Donald Trump is bellicose and gross in so many ways. But it's when you think about all the wars that this country has been in over the years, it's not just people like Donald Trump who have got us there. It's the so-called best and brightest who led us into Vietnam. And it's people like Zbigniew Brzezinski, who was considered a very brilliant fellow. And he was the one who devised this strategy in Afghanistan, where we supported these religious fanatics with the idea of getting the Soviets to invade. That was the whole idea of the thing right from the start. We didn't realize it at first. A lot of people don't realize it now. But Brzezinski admitted this, that the U.S. was there. So actually, the U.S. has been involved in Afghanistan for more than 17 years, more like 40 years. And so these people who, you know, have a lot of credence, you know, they seem rational. They don't brag about weird stuff like Donald Trump does. But in some ways, they're just as deadly, and their mistakes are costing us just as much. So it's we are in a situation where we are choosing between two kinds of warmongers. And I'll leave it to you to decide which is worst. Anyway, that is Fight the Empire for today. And stay tuned to KBOO, your radio station, for Chris Andre and Air Cascadia. Thank you.